Hello and welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main issue. I'm Oksana Smerichuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the stories that were in the news this week.
Ukrainian police entered a government meeting in Kyiv and, in front of the cameras, arrested two high-ranking officials on suspicion of corruption.
The fluctuation in violence over the past 2 weeks reflects fluctuating civilian casualty figures. Last week, with decreased violence levels, saw 6 civilian casualties, one of whom was killed. The week before, we confirmed 16 cases, including 5 fatalities.
Freedom House and other organizations are concerned about the tendency of Ukrainian government to block information, block access to resources, to websites, because we think that it will make it more difficult for people to access information, news, to express themselves. As far as we've seen so far, this decision wasn't made in a way that's consistent with the expectations in a democratic society.
Сегодня Украинская Рада приняла в первом чтении проект документа об изменениях закона об языке аудиовизуальной продукции в эфире общенациональных каналов. Там доля передач на украинском должна составлять не менее 75%. У региональных вещателей не меньше половины программ.
Language laws passed on TV broadcasting. The Ukrainian parliament passed a bill this week requiring that a minimum of 75% of TV broadcasting be in Ukrainian. The bill was passed by a majority of legislators and will be law once signed by the president. The language quotas will be in place from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. on air. The 75% minimum would apply to national broadcasters, but local and regional broadcasters may have a 50% minimum Ukrainian language content. This ruling follows a law adopted in November last year, establishing a Ukrainian language quota for radio. It also requires a minimum of 50% radio broadcasting in Ukrainian. Also, Ukrainian songs are to feature more prominently on radio. The starting quota was 25%, increasing to 35% over the following year. Tax officials arrested in an anti-corruption crackdown. Ukrainian authorities have arrested 23 high-ranking tax officials who were working with ex-president Yanukovych's associates. According to Interior Minister Arsen Avakov, the officials arrested had been involved in helping the Yanukovych family avoid paying 96 billion hryvnia in taxes. The massive crackdown was announced by Ukraine's chief military prosecutor, Anatoly Matios, on the 24th of May. The operation involved more than 1,700 police officers and about 500 military prosecutors who conducted raids in 15 regions across Ukraine. The tax officials were detained and brought before courts in Kyiv. Most have been released on bail while waiting for further hearings. Further news on the ban on social networks. We reported last week that Ukraine had increased its sanctions against Russia by banning certain social networks, Odnoklassniki and VKontakte, and Yandex online services. In the past week, there has been a varied reaction to this move in different parts of Ukrainian society. On the one hand, human rights organizations and journalists and many users of the networks criticized this ban, saying that it limited the freedom of expression and was undemocratic. There was a high volume of users of these networks, around 20 million users daily. Yet, on the other hand, this move was supported by many Ukrainians and particularly by people from the government and security services who felt that a ban like this was long overdue, particularly since the social networks were being used as instruments of information warfare. The head of SBU's Security Services of Ukraine, Vasily Hritsak, explained the need to restrict access to Russian social networks because they are used by the Russian propaganda machine to brainwash citizens. Hritsak stated that the SBU had found over 800 anti-Ukrainian communities in these networks. In a related move, Ukrainian border guards expelled the head of the news service at the Ukrainian channel Inter, Igor Shuvalov, who is a Russian citizen. He was declared persona non grata for spreading propaganda, according to the Interior Ministry of Ukraine. According to MP Anton Heraschenko, Shuvalov's presence in the media was used by the special services of the Russian Federation in anti-Ukrainian active measures. He was involved in a large-scale campaign to disrupt European integration reforms and was actively promoting Russian policy. The war. This week was relatively lucky for the servicemen of the Ukrainian armed forces, as there were no soldiers killed on the front lines. However, due to the ongoing hostilities, 26 soldiers were wounded in action. There was shelling this week all along the front line, but the area around Avdiivka was a hotspot and shelling destroyed some private houses. The Ministry of Defense commented that the two areas that experienced the most provocations were around Avdiivka and in the Mariupol area near Mariinka.
Peter Solomon is the Professor Emeritus of Political Science, Law, and Criminology at the University of Toronto. He's one of the co-founders and longtime director of the Petro Yatsik Program for the Study of Contemporary Ukraine at the University of Toronto's Monk School of Global Affairs. He specializes in post-Soviet politics and the politics of law and courts, and is one of the world's leading experts on judicial reform in Russia and Ukraine. He's been involved in the Support for Judicial Reform in Ukraine program, sponsored by the Canadian and Ukrainian governments for a number of years. And this week, he was in Kyiv to speak at a major international conference on independent judges and free media, synergy for the future. I'm Marta Dichok for Hromadske Radio's Ukraine Calling. Professor Solomon, thank you very much for finding the time to speak to us.
Well, it's a pleasure, Marta.
Legal and judicial reforms are arguably the foundation for all other reforms, since if courts don't function properly, then it's impossible for individuals to protect their rights. Ukraine's been reaching out to international experts for advice in this area for the past two decades, with, I would suggest, mixed results. Let's start with the conference you were attending this week. Could you please describe it to our listeners? What was the purpose of the conference? Who were the organizers, the participants? And what were the main findings, the main outcomes of the event?
Well, this is a conference that bringing together representatives of the courts, judiciary on the one hand, and media on the other. It's part of an effort, I would say, to give some serious national attention to this, to a, what I would say is a nagging problem in Ukraine, which is the problem of how courts are presented in the media. I don't think it's news to most of your listeners that public trust in courts, public evaluation of courts in Ukraine is very low. And it actually got worse after Euromaidan, in part because other branches of government encouraged criticism of judges. But in any case, you went from a situation where 15 to 20% of the public trusted the courts, which is kind of a norm in Southern and Eastern Europe, to single digits, you know, a situation where 5, 6% could say, and, you know, had some respect for courts, even though maybe more than that would actually go to courts. But they, so in our project, where we decided it was particularly timely to increase the attention that we gave and our Ukrainian partners gave to court media relations. And we've been, we're working in two regions, in the Odessa region and Ivano-Frankivsk, with judges, journalists, civil society organizations, advocates, on the whole panoply of measures that can, things that people can do to improve court media relations. Well, in this case, we're now dealing, trying to give this issue national attention. And this is very much desired by the leaders of both the judiciary and journalistic worlds. So the sponsors of this conference forum include Supreme Court of Ukraine, the High Qualification Commission, the High Council of Justice, as well as various media organizations. And in fact, the opening session, we had a lineup of very prominent figures coming and, as you might say, blessing the conference. And then there were over 100 judges and media people, many of the judges, not only from Kyiv, but from many parts of the country, and people who've thought a lot about what can be done in this area. Now, what I was presenting actually was a talk on comparative experience, on what is done in the United States, what's done in Western Europe. There are two different traditions. One of them, in the U.S. and Canada, staff of courts take on the role of helping journalists, explaining things, defining rules, working with them. In other words, press secretaries. Whereas in the European tradition, it's judges who do this. And what's emerged in the last 20 or 30 years is the role of press judge. One or two judges on a particular court who actually take on the responsibility of talking with journalists. And interestingly enough, what's been happening in Ukraine in the last two or three years is that both of these roles have emerged. And in fact, if you look at legislation or regulations, in the year and a half after Euromaidan, orders were sent out to courts throughout the country that they should have both of these roles. Now, the problem is that most of the people fulfilling them, even the staff positions, have backgrounds in law, not in communications, and don't really know what they should be doing. So training is something that we're working on. And at this conference, I was particularly impressed by some of the presentations by press judges from different parts of Ukraine who were talking about what their experiences and their challenges, and also court secretaries. So it was a very full program with a lot of speakers, and I think the most valuable thing is that judges of different who are worrying about these issues and journalists alike talked to each other and shared problems, shared perspectives. And one of the things that was done by the conference organizers is they took sort of quick instant polls, an instant poll at the beginning and one at the end of the conference. At the beginning, people were asked, what do you think is the state of relations between judges and journalists? And over 60% said, you know, bad or very bad. And they were asked at the end of the conference, well, on having had this meeting, what do you think the prospects are for the future? A substantial share of those people who had been so negative at the beginning showed some hope. And so it came out with much more positive answers. So we have the sense that the conference did accomplish something for the individual members, people who attended, and it's also clear that the subject got tremendous media attention. I mean, as an event involving media, naturally there was lots of journalistic coverage. Lots of little quick TV interviews. Even I did a couple of interviews in Russian with people from different parts of the country. So, in short, that's what this event is about.
That sounds really interesting. You mentioned that judges are meant to fulfill the role of informing the public. Could you explain how that's supposed to work? I don't know that I've ever heard this before.
Well, they're not.
Are they supposed to hold like press conferences regularly? Well,
it is. It's that sort of thing. In fact, I was talking about what's done in Netherlands and Spain and so on. And yes, not just any judge, but the press judge in particular, say there's a high profile case, a case that people are very interested in. Well, periodically that press judge, presumably not the judge who's actually handling the case in the courtroom, would either do a press conference or meet with journalists or try to explain things. And if you're lucky enough to have a court where there's also a press secretary, then the two can work together. In Spain, they discovered a lot of judges don't know how to talk to journalists.
Well, a very different skill set. Absolutely.
Exactly, and they need help. They do need help. But I suppose, I mean, in this part of the world, it's interesting, the idea of a judge being responsible for connecting to society is not as strange as it is in the Anglo-American world. If you think about it, in Soviet times, judges were indeed expected to, they were expected to, in the 20s and 30s, go out to factories and talk about what they were doing. And when you move into the particularly post-Stalin period, when judges were elected, to be sure, in non-competitive elections, it was one of their duties was to go out and periodically and talk in public settings and explain what was going on. And in judges even had the obligation to hold office hours and let members of the public come and ask them questions. Well, we've actually in various international projects, we've been trying to discourage that sort of thing because it may give one side an advantage or at least the appearance of that. But I think I have the sense that it may become in the next 3 or 4 years, more common to have the judges doing this sort of thing than to have a staff person or at least a staff person who can devote a lot of time to it.
That's a very interesting historical context that it might be more easy to introduce these sorts of positions in a post-Soviet context. Something you said earlier about level of trust towards the courts and towards judges that has decreased since the Euromaidan protests. Do you have any insight what's causing this? Is this perhaps a matter that there's more freedom of speech, so people are expressing themselves more openly? Or is it your sense that the courts and judges have started performing more poorly than before? What's causing this?
Oh, I don't think they're performing more poorly. I think it's much more a matter of what appears in the media. I mean, it's a freer. I mean, the media, of course, is extremely open, and you know, I think the overwhelming majority of coverage of what goes on in the courts is negative. But then contributing to that, and what the judges have told me in many parts of the country, is the tendency of legislators and people in the executive branch to scapegoat judges, to say that's where the biggest problems of corruption are, or sometimes lawyers who lose a case that people are following will go to the press and say, well, the only reason we lost is because the other side paid more or something like that. So you get a lot of that stuff. But you know, there. Hopefully your listeners know that there is a major new wave of judicial reform underway,
that's what I wanted to touch on next, because that they've been introducing these reforms. So in your opinion, how successful have they been if they're still getting all this negative media coverage?
Well, this is early. I mean, remember, a reform isn't something that happens overnight. A key piece of legislation, there was a kind of agreement as to what sorts of changes in personnel and structures they would really go with from about a year ago. But let's put it this way. They're doing two things. They're trying to renew the judicial core, review the credentials of current judges, try to find ways of weeding out people who either are incompetent or there's signs of that they must be corrupt because they're living style is so much, the cars they drive or they couldn't possibly afford in any other way. So there's this big process of reattestation that's been going on. In fact, that started even before a year ago. And some judges, frankly, don't want to put up with it. They don't want to do it, either because they find it offensive or, frankly, because they think they'll be shown up. So a lot of judges have left, have retired early, moved out. And we're actually in a situation now where even though there are nearly 9,000 places for judges in the country. There are only about 5,000 judges working. There are a lot of vacancies. And actually, and that there also are, that includes the judges who had had 5-year terms but and are, came up for life appointment, but the RADA decided that they had to go through the whole new attestation and appointment process. So they're actually people who are attached to courts and being paid salaries, but are not not allowed to hear cases. So, but I mean, all this, there's a, so it, I mean, it's very early to know what will come of this, but there will be a lot of new judges eventually, and hopefully the there'll be new social expectations that will translate into new norms. It's not clear that that will happen, because the, if the old incentive structures are there, the old system of evaluation, new judges may behave rather the way older ones did. But the other thing that's going on is big-time institutional change, and we'll see what comes of that. They've changed the functions of the High Council of Judges, of the High Qualifications Commission, changed the composition of these bodies, and I must say, from what I see of them, they are they're performing their functions, selection, promotion, discipline, much better than they used to, and certainly in a more transparent way. But the other big institutional change relates to the top courts. They'd reached a point under Yanukovych where, in addition, the Supreme Court had been cut down and made quite small, and there were three high courts, high cassation courts, the one for administrative cases, one for the commercial, and then the one for civil and criminal, which did most of the work. And if you took those three courts plus the Supreme Court, you had, I guess, nearly 400 judges at the peak of the system. Well, decision was made that those three high cassation courts are all going to be eliminated, and a new Supreme Court is being formed, which could have 200 judges, but will start with 120. And the extraordinary thing of this winter and spring that everybody is watching is the process of selecting judges for this new Supreme Court.
Well, this is what I wanted to get you to focus on. Who judges the judges? How do you set up a system where you have a tradition of corruption in the courts and a political will to clean that up, but who's in a position to make these evaluations? What's that process?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's a very complex process. Well, first of all, the body that decides on which people will make it through the competition is the High Qualifications Commission. It has a new composition. It includes some judges, but also lawyers, scholars. It's a mixture of people, and they themselves were pretty seriously vetted. So that's number one.
And who did the vetting of that commission?
Well, the different people who were handling the selections, the judges.
So No.
Like the advocates were selected by an advocate organization, the judges by the, I guess, the council or the Congress of Judges, I don't remember which level. But what I wanted to say is, I mean, to answer your question, it's important to add that there's another body involved, this so-called Public Integrity Council, which is a about 15 people who work voluntarily. Two-thirds of them are from the so-called Reanimation Group, which is a sort of radical reform group that emerged after Euromaidan.
Out of civil society.
Coming out of civil society. And these are folk who, and they get to review the dossiers and material on every candidate, at least that passes the introductory stage, and issue an assessment. And they have three or four different grades. And if they issue a negative assessment, if they say this person's should not be a judge because we see signs of corruption or some other ethical problems, it's an ethical review, then this information goes back to the commission, and the commission is allowed to, they can proceed in the competition only if 11 out of 15 members of the commission decide to overrule the Integrity Council. And that's how, you know, we don't know what the total picture will be, but I had a long conversation actually this weekend with one of the members of the council, so I'm sort of up to date on what they're up to, they're trying very hard, and one of the other things to say is that this whole process is extraordinarily transparent. The reports of this council are public. The sessions of the Qualifications Commission, and include not just the group as a whole, but interviews that they do with candidates for the positions at different stages. These are all available. You can watch them online on the website of the Qualifications Commission. It's really quite extraordinary. And the same thing, if you want to get some of it, there's the newspaper, Sudebna Yuridicheska Gazeta, also carries a lot of this material.
It sounds like the process is very well organized. You've got political actors, professional actors, civil society actors, transparency. Something that, as I was listening to you speak, occurred to me, what happens if they can't find enough honest judges? What does that do?
Good question. Well, I think they're okay. I mean, given the standards. Well, this is a big competition. It was open not only to people who were working as judges, including, you know, a lot of those people on the high courts that are being abolished, but also for the first time to academics and practicing lawyers. And in fact, 30% of the applications were from those categories. And now some of them aren't going to do well because they couldn't get the dossiers together or other things. But my guess is that the new Supreme Court in the end will be at least 10% from people who came from the side, so stunningly, you know, and represent kind of completely new blood. You know, I mean, one of the things about reaching there through a judicial career is that you become something of a conformist. Remember that Ukraine has the same system as most West European countries, where you become a judge a few years after law school. It's not like Canada or U.S. where it's something normally for mid-career, where you've worked for 20 years in a legal capacity. But if you work your way up the judicial bureaucracy, you tend not to be innovative or independent-minded in the way you approach issues, whereas some of these other people, I think, may well introduce a new degree of energy and creativity.
Well, is there, I don't know if this is within your realm of expertise, but to attract talented new people with good qualifications, there's an economic dimension.
Oh, yes.
In your view, from what you know, is there enough economic incentive for these well-trained, legally trained people with integrity to enter state service, as it were?
Well, I hope so. I mean, they've raised the salaries quite drastically. I don't have the figures in front of me, but the position of judge on the Supreme Court will be extremely well paid, and even judges on lower courts are going to get a lot more than they did. And even so, they were moving. They were doing better than comparable civil servants, better than procurators, for example. So I think there's a recognition that paying judges properly is a necessary condition for a new quality of justice, although probably not a sufficient one.
Mm. So from everything you've said, it sounds like the reforms are moving forward, and yet public opinion about judges continues to be low. So how do we fix that problem?
Well, you develop a communication strategy. You develop for the country, for particular courts. You develop practice. I mean, that's the whole idea, is that if you have we've got to remember that the tradition, if you go back certainly 10 or 15 years, was for courts to do almost nothing for journalists. And if anything, not only not have nice guidelines that say when you can use cameras and when you can do this, when you do that, and not explaining what's going on with big cases, but even making it hard for journalists to get into the courtroom. A lot of judges didn't want journalists around. In fact, to this day, some of them are quite suspicious of journalists. They think they'll say, oh, they're all on somebody's payroll and they're just going to, you know, they're corrupt. You think we're corrupt. What about those journalists? I mean, there's all kinds of traditional misperceptions that are exaggerated perceptions that need to be overcome. I think if and when Ukraine really does, when most courts start dealing with journalists and with the society around them in an effective way, I think public trust in the courts will change. And it's not something you expect overnight. I think you don't measure it in months, you measure it in years as a minimum. And if in that same period you have new judges, courts that work better, that help people better, and all that gets reported. You see, that's the whole idea, is to somehow give the people on the courts have to give journalists something newsworthy that's positive.
Mm. Well, maybe Ukraine needs a Law and Order type of a TV show to explain how things work.
Well, I think it has some. I mean, that's a whole other subject. But those have to be done very carefully too. Actually, I remember from the Spanish story that when they started working, have the press judges working, they one of their goals was to overcome to tell well to correct misperceptions that a lot of the journalists had about the way what courts did, which were based on American television shows that are shown in Spain. So, I mean, you know, it's like everything else. It's a question of how good they are. But
well, it sounds like there's room for hope in this area, that reforms are on track, and it's just a matter of keeping them that way. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that I haven't asked you?
Well, I don't know. We didn't mention the Constitutional Court, which is having all kinds of trials and tribulations, and very much. I think the judges there are afraid. They've got some very big controversial cases that they're ducking. It's kind of a weak spot that I worry about. There's also the biggest problem, of course, is the context. I mean, this is a country that, as you know, as everybody knows, is at war, has a declining economy, and it's not easy to change institutions in that context. And when you talk about corruption is, of course, not something that was ever unique to judges and courts. It's a general government problem.
Well, a societal problem.
And how do you
offer bribes all the time.
So. I know. So it's it's different. You know, I stop and think, well, okay, suppose we have a regional court where the judges really are different and have a different attitude and do their stuff. Well, what about their staff? Staff of courts in Ukraine are paid miserably. A huge gap. I mean, as judges' salaries kept going up, not much of the staff. And There's no question but that in some courts, the money is paid by litigants that basically goes to support staff. And they often it's both sides that pay money, and it's more of a service fee than a, you know, than an inducement. And but again, if that kind of practice continues, it will public will remain cynical. So these are complicated matters, in short.
They are indeed. They are indeed. But I think you've given our listeners a very insightful picture into what is happening and what still remains to happen.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for finding the time to speak to us. And we'll hope to speak to you again.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, everybody should remember that the work of this forum and conference was above all part of a wonderful Canadian reform project, as you said at the beginning.
We've been speaking to Peter Solomon, an expert on legal and judicial reform, professor from the University of Toronto. I'm Marta Dechok for Hromadske Radio. Thanks for listening.
And now in culture. In a country that is undergoing reforms, budgets for culture tend to shrink and cultural needs tend to become low priority, which leaves a lot of scope for community activists. One large project that has been gathering traction this spring is #SOSMaibutnye, or #SOSFuture. The idea is to gather grassroots support to identify cultural sites and community places that need rescuing and to build up a national register on a website. Once the sites have been identified, private donors can contribute, and organizers are hoping that government grants, local and international, will also be found. The idea is to restore significant cultural heritage sites through crowdfunding. One example of a site that is targeted by SOS Future as needing attention is the Park with Folk Sculptures located in Severodonetsk. It has a unique collection of outdoor folk art and has been a focal point for local community, but now has deteriorated, and being located in the Donetsk Oblast close to the front line hasn't helped. This week on Thursday, one group of SOS Future cultural volunteers, spearheaded by the Art Ukraine Foundation, set to restoring Shotarustavely Square in Kyiv, which has been an outdoor community space, a focal point for Georgian culture and literature in Kyiv, but has which sadly become neglected. The volunteers, assisted by a class of schoolchildren and some support from Kyiv city gardeners, restored plantings, removed graffiti, and cleaned the square. In general, the idea was to make it user-friendly again. But this was something of a warm-up act for more ambitious projects on the register, such as the Park of Sculptures in Severodonetsk, or the odd castle or two. And now for some music. Here's a song for you about spring. It was performed in the 1970s by the Kyiv band Vizerunki Shlakhiv that featured the now legendary Taras Petrenenko. It's a love song about spring, but because it contains lyrics about the gold sun reflecting in the blue sky, the colors of the then banned Ukrainian flag, the Soviet authorities frowned upon it. Have a listen and see what feelings this retro song evokes in you.
Як мить про
In looking forward, next week, Bohdan Mihailo will be hosting the show and looking at Ukraine and international issues. Tune in for a new episode, and we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Oksana Smerochuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.